session number 4427, reel 3.
Brigadier McNab, reel 3. You were saying about the daily routine, Brigadier McNab. Can you tell me what the daily routine was in the KR?
Well, as I say, PT, and then you had individual training, weapon training, which led to eventually a classification, whether they were marksmen or first-class shots or what they were. And they got, I think, extra pay for being a marksman and a first-class shot. So it was to their, in their interest to be good shots. And they were naturally good shots once they learnt what to do. And they had far better eyesight, for instance, 600 yards and that sort of thing. They could see the target much better than a lot of us could. We did do one or two efforts at bush warfare. You'll get hollow squares moving through bush and bugle calls, turn right, turn left, all the Boer War stuff. But
you mean a specific bugle call indicating,
yes,
turn,
indicating
right,
turn right, turn left, whatever it was. And then you did a little bit of fire and movement. Taught them how, in order to go forward, you had one lot prepared to shoot to enable another lot to go forward. And then that lot lay down and then another one. And, you know, all very simple elementary section training, that sort of thing. But one never had the battalion all together, you see. There were only three companies in my day, before the brigade thing started. And one was in Turkana, and one was in Karamoja, and one was at headquarters in Bombo. And, of course, the Turkana and the Karamojong one was mostly spent up with these long patrols and things.
Did they usually have their afternoons free?
Yes.
What did they do with their spare time?
Oh, what all soldiers do in their spare time? Sit about, you know, Africans.
Sitting about talking?
Yes. Oh, yes. And they had their families with them, you see.
Did you ever come across any problems with juju in East Africa?
Well, I had one case, a very queer case, which taught me a lesson, was that there was a fellow who was due to go on leave, but there was only one lorry, and he had to get to Kitgum from Kakamari, which was quite a long way, and the lorry was absolutely crammed to bursting. And he arrived with a sheep. And there was obviously no room for the sheep. And I said, no, you can't go. You can't go. Not if you take that sheep. And he said, well, I'm not going unless I can take the sheep. I said, all right, well, don't go. Well, this chap, from that moment on, started wasting away. And so much so that the sub-assistant surgeon was called in about this chap, you see, and sub-assistant surgeon couldn't find anything wrong with him. And this chap came to me again, and he said, unless you will let me go with my sheep, I'm going to die. And I said, don't be stupid. I'm going to die. He said, yes, I shall die. He said, this sheep has got my grandmother's soul, and I've got to take it back to my own home, Kitgum Matidi, or whatever it was. And I laughed. A little bit stupid, you see. I thought he was just pulling my leg. Anyway, he wasted away, and he died. And there was no cause other than the wish to not to live.
Was he refusing to take food?
He ate. But you know, he didn't eat voraciously or anything. He just wasted away. It was some emotional thing inside him.
Which tribe did he belong to?
He was an Acholi. And it certainly taught me a lesson that you've got to take these sort of things seriously.
Did you ever come across any similar things?
No, it was the only real case I had. I had another very interesting medical thing. My head servant was a newbie. He wasn't enlisted, but he came on these patrols with me to look after me. And he got what I took to be pneumonia. And we were right out on the borders of Sudan in a dry riverbed. And he had a temperature of 104. And I thought, well, I don't know what the devil to do about this. My father was a surgeon, and I knew that I'd once had pneumonia, and I was given poultices, linseed poultices. And so I hadn't got any linseed or anything like that, but I boiled up water and put cotton wool in a handkerchief and squeezed it out and kept it on his chest, you see. And I did this for a bit, nothing happened, and I thought, well, he's going to die. And a corporal, a newbie, came and he said, let me have a go. I said, well, what are you going to do? And he said, well, I'm going to if you give me a razor blade, I'm going to cut the skin in his chest, and I'll get a cow's horn and bore a hole in the tip, and I shall make this cut, and I shall suck in the cow's horn. Now it'll suck blood until there's no more blood coming out and there's water. And in that water is the bug that's biting him. And I thought, well, I don't know, but far rather that he kills him than I do. And so I let him do it. And he recovered. And I wrote to my father about this. And he said, oh, yes, he said, it's a primitive form of cupping.
So there really was some medical benefit.
Relieved the pressure on the lung.
What about religious customs and observances in the KR?
Well,
was there much of that?
Well, there were. You see, the Dubi was a Mohammedan, but a pretty poor Mohammedan. I think he went for rather the sort of outward and visible sign rather than the inward and spiritual grace. For instance, they used to drink like fish if they got a chance and that sort of thing. They insisted on halal meat. They had to see the throat was cut and all that sort of thing. But all the others were pagans, unless they were mission boys. But we had very few Christians. They were mostly pagans.
Did the provision of halal meat for the newbies cause you any problems of supply, or was it straightforward?
No.
What about Ramadan? Did they observe?
Yes. All the newbies did. But, of course, the other tribes didn't.
Did that interfere with military performance?
Not really, no. They got a bit sort of emaciated and bad-tempered and idle. But everybody was very excited at the end of Ramadan. You know, anybody seen the moon? All this business.
What about promotion procedures for the Askaris? How did you go about promoting someone?
Well, really, it was, as I say, a paternalistic affair, and you knew your soldiers jolly well. You had nothing else to do, you see. Other than take an interest in them. And, of course, the other interest was taking an interest in the people amongst whom you lived, the Karamajong, the Dadoth, were awfully interesting people to me. They loved dancing, and they didn't use drums. They like the Maasai in Kenya, they leap straight up in the air and come down, bonk, like that. And they have these wonderful songs, which I learnt. And it's things like, who's been eating the grain? Nobody knows, perhaps it's a mouse. And I've got a cow the colour of curdled milk, and it's got horns like this. And all these lovely songs, the song of the wind and so on. And I used to, at the full of the moon each month, I used to have a big dance in Goma and ask all the local inhabitants to come. And it used to go on all night, and I used to dance with them, which was, if you could put up with the stink, it was most awful fun. In fact, I've taught my grandchildren to dance some of the dances. I don't know, what with the shooting and, taking interest in your askaris and the local inhabitants, there's also, I was never bored. And I spent sometimes as much as 3 months without ever speaking English.
Did the Africans welcome your interest in their affairs and customs, or did
they suspicious? Oh, yes, rather. Roars of laughter when I got in the middle and tried to leap in the air as high as they did. Yes.
Did the Africans at this stage accept that they could only rise so far as promotion was concerned, or was there any resentment become officers?
None at all. No.
So, you were in Africa much later, right up to 1957. In your experience, when did this come in, if at all?
You know, I would have said that right the way up till 1954, anyway, it didn't seem to be within their ken. I don't know what... certainly, it wasn't noticeable. I didn't notice it. But we did then start thinking, well, into the winds of change and all the rest of it, we better get moving, put it smartly.
Was this because of Mau Mau?
Yes. Mau, you see, nobody could get independence, certainly in Kenya, until Mau Mau had been defeated. But once Mau Mau was defeated, people realized that things were moving rather faster than expected. And although I was told when I retired in 59, I went back to Kenya to retire, and I wanted to some assurance as to how long I would have to make a market garden out of a patch of Africa and so on. I was assured by no less a person than the then Minister of State for Commonwealth Relations that I'd have at least 15 years. In fact, I had 5 before independence went so fast. And we were caught on the hop over that, undoubtedly. But I don't think it would have made any difference, really. People like Idi Amin, who went from company sergeant major to lieutenant colonel overnight, I think that even if he'd been made an officer earlier on, the leopard doesn't change its spots. And I think that he'd have probably gone exactly the same way, even if he'd come up gradually.
What servants did you employ whilst you were serving with the KR?
Well, I had a head boy, and I had his number two. And needless to say, the number two did most of the work, you know. And then you had the kitchen Toto, who did even more menial jobs. And then you had the dog boy, de-ticking the dog.
How did he do that?
Well, he just sat on the ground and went through and pulled out. The
mechanical.
I had four. The head boy cooked. My head boy used to cook as well.
How did you recruit the servants?
Passed on, mostly, from officers who tried them and proved them. I had a simply splendid chef called Rajab Masal, who was a newbie. And they were passed on, really, from chef to chef. In fact, when I went up to Karamoja, I took on my predecessor's stores. And he believed in doing himself well. And he had 12 monthly boxes, all put up by Fortnum and Mason, so that you had 10 grouse in August, and so on, and lavatory paper, toothbrush, and all the rest of it, all in these monthly boxes. And I paid him the magnificent sum of £100 for 12 boxes. Your Fortnum and Mason's stuff. Mind you, one shot a lot of meat, and one shot guinea fowl and spur fowl and so on. But a box lasted me. In fact, I didn't finish all the boxes.
did you ever have to dismiss a servant?
No, I never did. No, I never had to. I think people did have to, but I was very lucky in my lot.
Which tribes did they come from?
Varied. I had a great business with newbies, simply because my head chap was a newbie. I found them the best, really.
Apart from the contact which you had with the tribes with whom you danced, did you have any other contact with African civilians?
No. No, none at all.
Was that typical?
I think so, yes. You see, when you were at Bombo, there was a larger European community. For instance, when I used to go into Kampala, which was only 18 miles away, and play rugger, then there was the club, the Kampala club, and so on. And so one wasn't thrown together with one's Africans in the same way as you were up country. You lived a very primitive life up country, and you were either in a tent or a mud hut. And you were surrounded by Africans and nobody else. And so, other than reading your book, one did a tremendous lot of talking to Africans. And it was limited to the extent that you couldn't go into any great philosophical problems or anything like that. But you got them to tell you a few things about themselves and their customs and so on.
Did you ever tell them anything about the British way of life in your term?
I didn't think one did, because they wouldn't have been capable of understanding it, you see. I mean, even at the beginning of the war, I was commanding a Nyaslan battalion, and they thought that the ship that took us to Madagascar was doing this because it had long, long things with wheels. And the reason that they were doing this was that there were sort of various undulations in the ground which was making them do that.
And making them go up and down.
They didn't think they were floating. They thought it had wheels.
But didn't, in these conversations you had with them, didn't they ever say, well, you know, how do you do this at home?
Yes,
in Britain?
Well, you sort of, they were awfully interested in the king and things like that. And Well, to illustrate the thing, some people were sent home for the victory parade. And this is quite late on, 1940-something. And I asked a chap what impressed him most. And he said the number of butcher shops in London. How can they have all that meat, all those butcher shops all over London? Where does it come? Where are all the cattle? Where do they... You see, it's essentials.
What did they make of the idea of the king?
Oh, you see, they only thought in terms of chiefs, you see, and they couldn't quite make out how wonderful person he must be to be king of Britain and all these other countries.
Did they have any kind of geographical concept of Britain at all, or did they just think it was a part of Africa or something?
No, they had no idea. You see, for instance, for some reason or other, my servants very often, I had a picture of my mother and father in my mud hut on a table. And inevitably, after he'd been dusting, they were the wrong way up. They couldn't see a picture in those days. Now, of course, naturally they do. But servants didn't know a photograph one way up from the other.
Could any of the Africans in the KR read and write? Were any of them literate?
The company clerk was about the only chap. They made sort of marks and things. Even King Kerala, the Effendi, wasn't a very good writer. He couldn't write, really. The company clerk used to write his letters for him.
Coming on to your own conditions of service, what were the messing arrangements in the KR at headquarters?
At headquarters you had a mess, and you paid, exactly the same as you do in a regiment at home. You generally lost money on the messing and made money on the drink, you know, the same old game as you have in messes in all over the world, or clubs for that matter. Up country, of course, you were completely on your own.
Was mess life at headquarters the same as it would be in Britain then, or was it less formal?
Just the same. You had guest nights and dressing for dinner at night and all that sort of thing.
You said earlier on that you had this bout of rheumatic fever.
Mm.
Did you fall ill at all on any other occasions in Africa?
No, I was very lucky.
So you never even got malaria?
Oh, I'm sorry, I beg your pardon, yes I did. I used to get malaria, and I got a paratyphoid, I forgot, yes I did. And that was coming down, this was in my second tour, when I was up in a place called Wajir, in the northern frontier of Kenya. And Rajab Mursal had a wife called Asuza. And I had been on patrol, and I'd come back, and she made some gruel, some posho. It's sort of rather sloppy, sort of porridgey stuff. And she said, "Would I like some?" And I said, "Yes, thanks awfully, I'll have some." And I ate this gruel, and I went down the next day by lorry to Meru, which was the headquarters of the 3rd KR, and I woke up not feeling at all well. And eventually, the high temperature, I was taken by motor car during the rains, which was the most awful, hairy journey down to Nairobi. And it was discovered that I had paratyphoid, which I obviously must have caught from this woman's posho.
And what medical attention did you get for that?
Oh, I went to the hospital in Nairobi, and I was very well looked after. And all my hair fell out.
Did it grow again?
No.
Were there any problems for the bachelor officers in Africa with the KR? The fact that there were very few European women there?
Not that I know of. No. You see, for instance, in Karamoja, I didn't see a white woman till I got back to Kitale. 14 months later. In fact, all it did to me was fear of what the hell I was going to say. I had nothing to say to them, you know. I remember trying to buy I hadn't got a collar stud, and I went to the Kitale Club. I was told I had to put on a tie. Well, I had a tie, but I hadn't got a collar stud. So I went to White Away in Laidlaw's, and there was a little ginger-haired girl behind the counter, and I rushed out to the shop, terrified, got somebody to buy my collar stud for me.
This was because of all the time you'd spent in the blue.
Mm. I think that, by and large, the more gregarious the officer who went up north and found himself on his own for long periods, the happier he was and the more he enjoyed the whole thing, and it didn't affect him. But the rather indrawn, shy person, he didn't weather it so well. It's a funny thing. You'd have thought it would be the other way around, but it didn't turn out that way. One or two people went a bit queer as a result of going up there on their own, and they all seemed to be the chaps who were pretty sort of silent, quiet chaps. And people like me who enjoyed life didn't want to come down. I suppose we were abnormal to the extent that when a Helio message arrived saying that I was to be relieved, I sent the Helio back saying, please not.
Was any notice taken?
No, not at all. They just said I'd gone round the bend like all the rest.
When you say they went a bit queer, you mean got depressive?
Yes. One fellow, who's been nameless, he went to the KAR in order to save money to get married. When he was sent up there, and he was highly delighted at being sent up there, he came down very sort of odd and went home, and his fiancée met him in Southampton, and they motored up to London, and they went out to dinner, and she burst into tears, and she said, I'm terribly sorry, but I can't marry you, you're quite different. Very sad story.
Were there any suicide cases or anything like that?
No, not that I know of.
So, when somebody got in this kind of state, could anything be done? Were they just shipped off?
A tour was the period of gestation of an elephant, 30 months. So it wasn't an awful long time, really. And I don't think that probably they carried it on for life. You know, I think once they got back into civilization, they probably got all right again. I certainly, it was a bit odd. I got onto the Landaff Castle around the south, and I didn't talk to anybody, the female sex, until I got to Cape Town. And I sat in the bar and the Pig and Whistle at the back of the boat, reading my book, which incidentally was, I can remember to this day, Jock of the Bushveld it was. And I used to listen to people talking. I used to say, good Lord, if I hadn't got anything better to say than that, I'd keep my mouth shut. And that was my attitude right the way until I got to Cape Town. And then I went to a horse show or something or other and snapped out of it.
Did any of the officers keep African mistresses, or was that...
Not that I know of. I certainly didn't. The Karamojong were not conducive to that sort of thing.
But in other areas where the African women might be more attractive.
Oh yes, I think there were, but they certainly didn't in my day because it was frowned on very much.
Would the regiment have taken any measures if they'd have found?
Oh yes. No, it wasn't on. I think earlier on in it was, but certainly not by the time I got there.
Did you think that the 30-month tour of duty was the right length?
It awfully depended where you were stationed. I think that if you were up in places like the northern frontier, Kenya, Lake Rudolph and so on, I think that was just about right. But in places like Meru, the highlands of Kenya, I would have said you could have done longer, really. But you see, the 30 months, it was 30 months in the country, and then you had your months going and your months coming, you see, and then you had 5 months leave at home.